Dear listener, we hope that you've been enjoying the variety of podcasts that we have on our network. Now is your opportunity to help us by telling us a little more about you. Please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey and complete our listener survey so that we can learn more about you and your listening habits. Again, please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Thinman. We have a delicious show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we will be interviewing author Deborah Prince, a book called On the Chocolate Trail. And we're doing this in conjunction with an evening, which is being an afternoon, which is being presented by the Jewish Federation FedEd program at the DIA. Did you know that there's a chocolate coffee tea exhibit going on right now at the DIA? It's been there for a whole long time. But they're having a Jewish afternoon, Sunday, February the 26th, 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. We'll give details of that later. We have a full variety of Jewish music throughout the show. The portion of the week, which we'll be talking about in the second half hour of the show, is the portion of Yisro, which deals with the giving of the Torah and ancillary occurrences. We have a very insightful Hasidic story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. A 19-year-old Palestinian from the West Bank opened fire Thursday afternoon near an outdoor market in Petah Tikva, wounding six. The terrorist was arrested. No one suffered serious injuries. Three rockets were fired from Egypt towards Eilat. The Iron Dome anti-missile system intercepted all of them. A fourth rocket exploded in an uninhabited area. In response, the IAF, Israel's Air Force, bombed four Hamas buildings in Gaza. Two Arabs who were working in smuggling tunnels were killed by IAF bombs that hit their tunnel. A 31-year-old man was arrested and charged with a felony hate crime for breaking a window and posting swastikas on the Chicago Loop Synagogue, as it was called. More details to follow as they become necessary. Some lighter news. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft gave $6 million for a new football stadium near Jerusalem. The regulation NFL stadium is one of three to be built this decade. There are, believe it or not, 13,000 members of the American Rules Football League in Israel. That's a lot of people playing football. And finally, here's some really interesting good news. Israelis donated more than 300 tons of winter coats, blankets, and boots to refugees in Syria. Any label with Hebrew or saying Israel was removed to take away any political stigma. The Zionist youth movement organized the donation program. Go, guys. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. When I told my board up last week that I was going to be doing this show, he just already got all really excited. Just real serious, because I suppose chocolate is like everybody's love. So with no further anything, we have online Deborah Prince, who's written a book called On the Chocolate Trail, and will be coming to Detroit on February 28th to speak at the DIA's chocolate exhibit. How are you, Deborah?
Doing great. Thank you so much, Herschel. Thanks for having me on today.
Good to hear. Thank you so much for taking time. Now, everybody, you don't have to talk about chocolate. Everybody knows about chocolate. In fact, back in 2007, when the market was tanking, I actually heard a financial advisor say quite seriously that people should divest their portfolios of banking stock and buy chocolate, because in times of depression, people want comfort. And what are they going to do? They're going to say, well, I can afford a chocolate bar, so chocolate stocks are going to go up. I didn't follow him because I don't have any money in the stock market at all. But so people eat chocolate when they're happy. People eat chocolate when they're depressed. Chocolate is like all over the place. So you, Debbie, wrote this book called On the Trail and turned somewhat of a hobby into something more than a hobby. How did you get your chocolate radar on?
Thank you for the question. So On the Chocolate Trail is the result of my chocolate radar, what I call my Choco Dar. It's an adult onset self-diagnosed syndrome that I have, and I've noticed comes upon me serendipitously, and it did lead to the research that led to the book On the Chocolate Trail. And I've been on the chocolate trail for a number of years doing the research, just as chocolate spread throughout the world from the new world to the old world and back to the new world. I've been following that trail in my research and now touring with the book since the book came out. And I first learned about the connections between Jews and chocolate when I was on a trip afforded by my congregation in San Diego at the time. And I was traveling in Paris, and I happened to go into a chocolate store that was not on my list of stores to visit. And I happened, Choco Dar, to pick up their company literature, and I happened to read in my high school French, Choco Dar, that Jews brought chocolate making to France. And in all my years of studying Judaism from my childhood and Sunday school and confirmation and Jewish studies classes in college, and then 5 years of the Hebrew Union College seminary preparation, I had never heard this idea that Jews brought chocolate making to France. And that's really how the connection for me to chocolate as a rabbi and a person interested in Jewish life and teaching about Judaism really kicked in.
Okay, that is actually fascinating. So let's go back to the history of chocolate. Chocolate is a new world import to the European imperialists, the Spanish, the Dutch, etc. I always associate Dutch chocolate as being like the drinking chocolate, and that's originally what it was. So, but in my travels, so chocolate was the result of the Europeans. Where did Jews fit in, say, like in the 1500s with the introduction of chocolate to Europe, Debbie Prince?
So when I first saw that literature, that company literature in Paris, in that chocolate store, I stepped back and I was perplexed. I'd never heard this. So as I said, and as I started to mull over this possibility that there was some connection between Jews, chocolate, Spain, the New World, I realized that, of course, Jews exiled from Spain and Jews who left because of the Inquisition, all of those Sephardim stayed connected, whether they were still practicing Jews, whether they were publicly Jewish, secretly Jewish, whether they had converted to Catholicism and remained practicing Catholics. They were all still connected through kinship and mercantile ties, wherever they went. And where they went were lots of places, of course. They went to the New World. They went to New Spain. They went to London. They went to Amsterdam. They went to France. And in all of these lines of dispersion from Spain, one could also trace and notice that these became or were chocolate centers. So Jews were very involved in chocolate trade, chocolate manufacture, and chocolate retail in Newport, Rhode Island, in New York, in Bayonne, France, in the East Coast, I have to be sure to say Bayonne and not Bayonne.
Yeah, I really thought you meant New Jersey when I was reading the book.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there was a coincidence of chocolate specialist, Jewish chocolate specialist in Amsterdam, London, Oxford, England. And so there were these Jewish connections to chocolate in all of these chocolate centers.
Uh-huh. So would you say simultaneously as the Europeans are expanding out, where you have trade being brought back to Europe, like you have the Jews that are involved in, say, the Silk Trade, the Silk Road travel, you have the same thing going on with chocolate going the other way from east, from west to east then?
Well, from the New World to the Old World and back again, all through Sephardim, not exclusively Sephardim, initially Sephardim, the story becomes an Ashkenazi story later on. There were other sources of chocolate in the European trade. Catholic clerics probably helped diffuse chocolate into Europe, as did Jews. But Jews were very much involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Dutch were very involved with trade, and the Dutch welcomed the Jews after the expulsion in 1492. So I would assume that it would be a natural that since Jews who were living in the Netherlands were involved in merchandising, the East Indies Company, et cetera, there were probably Jews therefore involved in that whole intricate network then. Yes, Debbie Prince?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Herschel. So On the Chocolate Trail tells a number of amazing stories about Jews and chocolate and other religions as well. After all, it is an immigrant food, and it does travel with these Sephardi refugees initially. And one of the great stories that has to do with Amsterdam is a story about a gentleman living in Spain who was to be posted as ambassador in this period to Amsterdam. And he complained to his staff that he did not want to go. His name, by the way, was Gamara. I do not know if he was a crypto-Jew, a converso, if he had some sort of Jewish background or not. But he did not want to go to Amsterdam because he was afraid that he would not be able to access the chocolate that he was accustomed to drinking in Spain. And his staff assured him that he should go because there are great Jewish chocolate makers in Amsterdam.
Uh-huh. For political alliances then. Okay, so there were political alliances. I could imagine, though, chocolate being a luxury at first and was enjoyed by the aristocracy, were Jews who were involved in that also, say, persecuted, like in other areas where Jews got involved, Debbie?
So this is an interesting question. In New Spain, Jews were pretty much privately practicing their Judaism and not public about it because the Inquisition existed there. And they were very much afraid of being outed to the Inquisition by their chocolate drinking on Christian fast days or their not drinking chocolate on Jewish fast days. I tell stories about that in the book, in The Chocolate Trail. And in Bayonne, France, which is that, you know, initial connection for me to Jews and chocolate, Jews were in the chocolate business, but were not allowed to live in Bayonne proper. They had to live in the neighborhood of Saint-Esprit. They could not work on Christian feast days. They could not work on Sundays. There were those sort of, you know, same old story about anti-Semitism that those Jewish chocolate makers had to confront there. And despite that anti-Semitism, the chocolate makers, who are probably no longer Jewish at all in Bayonne, France, but there are a number of chocolate makers there today, still tell the story that Jews brought chocolate making to France. Okay. Of course, we will perhaps never know exactly who brought that first chocolate bean or that first chocolate making equipment or that first recipe to France. But France is very significant and substantial and beautiful. Chocolate industry still identifies its sources in Jews and Jews exiled from Spain bringing chocolate making to France.
Mm-hmm. Let me segue into that. Excuse me. Next week's guest is Bernard-Henri Lévy, who wrote a book called The Genius of Judaism, which spends, the first part talks about the development of French history paralleling the development of Jewish French history. So there, he maintains that there is a tremendous influence of Judaism in the development of what France is today. So tell us about then the introducing of chocolate to French society by Jewish people then, Deborah Prince.
Well, I think one could take a look at the French Postal Service produced a plate of chocolate-looking stamps, and it identifies the history of chocolate in France. And in this history, they point out Columbus, who, you know, some people think was Jewish, but maybe he was the first European on his fourth voyage to the New World to have contact with cocoa beans. One could say, if you believe that he was the first Jew to have contact with cocoa beans. But if not, if you don't believe that theory, then at least the members of his crew were conversos, some of them. And so those were Jews who had first European contact with chocolate. But that French Postal Service plate of stamps identifies him, shows beautiful shots of cocoa making equipment, chocolate pots, some of the beautiful items that we'll see in the exhibit, coffee, tea, and chocolate consuming the world at the DIA. The plate of stamps highlights Bayonne. And in Bayonne, they privilege the idea that Jews brought chocolate making to France. So it spread, this idea spread throughout France. It's not just told in Bayonne, but that's the story, one of the stories that they privilege about how chocolate came to France, and Jews were very much a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Deborah Prince, who wrote a book called On the Chocolate Trail, and Debbie will be speaking at the DIA on February the 28th in conjunction with the Jewish Federation's FedEd program. We'll talk about that later. Now, so Jews were, because of expulsions, pogroms, natural progressions, wind up moving eastward from Spain to Holland, to France, to Belgium. Then they move into Germany, Poland, Russia. Okay. My point of reference is always my bubby, my grandmother. My grandmother wasn't into chocolate at all because in her shtetl in Poland, they didn't have chocolate. So none of her cooking included anything chocolate. She didn't make chocolate anything. She didn't like drinking chocolate. She liked drinking tea because that's what they had in Poland. So was there a disconnect between, say, the Jews of Western Europe and the shtetl Jews, Debbie?
Well, that's a good question in terms of chocolate. So a lot of my stories center on the countries you mentioned before, Holland, France, England. There are more contemporary stories that link Eastern Europe, let's say, to chocolate. And one of them connects to Israel in a really fascinating way. That is that there was a company named Lema. It still exists, actually, now. Was founded by Jews, owned by Jews. One or a couple of the owners of that company decided to make Aliyah to Israel. This was a chocolate company in Riga, Latvia. And when he moved to Israel, made Aliyah to Israel in about 1933, he brought with him the recipe for the chocolate that they had made in Eastern Europe. And he founded, along with a few other partners, Elite Chocolate, now Elite Strauss, huge company, probably the most popular, most familiar Israeli chocolate. And of course, we know that Israelis are crazy for chocolate, or mishugah for chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the oldest man alive in the world is a chocolatier who was born in Poland or Lithuania, one of these places, now lives in Haifa and had like a small chocolate factory in Haifa since World War II. If you can validate that.
Well,
if you remember.
That's a great story.
So indeed, but so anyways, go ahead.
The rest of this story is that when the Soviet Union fell and fell apart, the company that had been nationalized by the Soviets and the recipe changed under Soviet rule to cheapen the product because it was too expensive otherwise. When the Soviet Union fell, people were able to access Elite chocolate in Riga and import it now because it is the familiar chocolate taste that they knew before the Soviet Union took over. And that's elite, the import elite.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very interesting. Okay. So now my wife has one of her dear friends when she was younger, bought herself a Euro pass and went all over, spent it in like 3 months traveling around Europe and et cetera, excuse me, with the goal of determining the best chocolate that Europe had to offer. And she went to all the different countries, and she even went to Luxembourg and to Monaco to see if there was any, what was there. And her opinion was that Belgian chocolate was the best and Russian and Israeli chocolate were the worst. How do you concur with that? And I see you gave good marks to Belgian chocolate. So what's the deal there? What makes a good chocolate? What makes a bad chocolate? And I actually just asked you three questions, but go ahead.
Well, thank you for all of those questions. Well, how lucky she was to be able to make that trip. And it's so interesting, her conclusion. You know, al kan bereach ein malahit fakeach, as Israelis say, on taste and smell, there's nothing to debate because it's also subjective. So, you know, when I'm with audiences, I often ask them which country's chocolate they enjoy the most. I generally say that I like the one that's right in front of me and I'm about to eat. However, that is my, you know, jokey answer. My more serious answer has to do with questions of Jewish values. So what's great about On the Chocolate Trail is that, for me personally, is that it's brought together my interest in Judaism, my interest in history, my interest in food, and my interest in teaching. And I could not really approach the question of chocolate eating. And by the way, that is the most frequently asked question I get. What is the best chocolate? Because everybody wants me to recommend a particular brand or a particular type. And I like to turn the question around into a conversation about Jewish values and religious values. And that is the focus of the last chapter of the book. And in fact, in the back of the book, in addition to a list of chocolate museums around the world, there is a list of chocolate companies sort of rated by or noted by the quality of the chocolate, how they make it. Are they green? Are they environmentally conscious? Are they tzedakah-minded? Do they give tzedakah? Are they connected to the community in any way? Do they support the community? How do they deal with their farmers? Are they fair trade? Are they kosher? So all of these issues are addressed in that list of chocolate companies. And I do a full discussion and talk around this question of what is the best chocolate from a Jewish values point of view. I do also, you know, how did Hanukkah gelt come to be chocolate? I can do something about Israeli chocolate. Certainly there's the historical connections in general about Jews and chocolate. I also like to discuss our American roots in chocolate making in the colonial period. Jews like Aaron Lopez and the Gomez family in New York were very, very involved in chocolate, the chocolate culture of the colonial period in our country. So what is the best chocolate is one of those many conversations I like to have with my audiences.
Okay, so if you're just joining us again, our guest today is Deborah Prince, has written a book called On the Chocolate Trail. We'll be coming to Detroit, speaking at the DAA as part of the FedEd program. The DAA is now currently, you can go visit it beforehand, has an exhibit about the art of tea, coffee, and chocolate. That's going on right now. It's a special exhibit there. So tell us about America and chocolate and Jews then, Debbie Prince. So you talk about the colonial times. I don't recall seeing anything that George Washington was sipping on hot cocoa at Valley Forge when it was freezing cold outside, but maybe you could inform us about that.
Well, I'm not so sure about Valley Forge, but in fact, and this is so appropriate for Washington's and Lincoln's birthdays coming up soon, there was a significant chocolate culture in North America in that period of time. And George Washington and Martha were serving chocolate for breakfast, along with tea and coffee, at Mount Vernon, in fact. They had chocolate pots, they had chocolate cups, some of the appurtenances that we'll see at this wonderful show. And there was a lot of chocolate, so much so, and so sort of inexpensive compared to Europe because of its close access and because there were no monopolies on chocolate here, that it was distributed to prisoners and soldiers, in fact. So it's possible he was drinking at Valley Forge. It was, in some cases, the part of the ration or allotments given, food allotments given out to soldiers in the colonial period. And these folks, like Lopez and Gomez and other Jews who were Sephardi in origin, were refugees to the to this nation and were very much furthered by their taste for chocolate and the business of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, also very involved in their Jewish communities. So the Gomez family in New York was giving tzedakah to the Spanish Portuguese synagogue. Aaron Lopez was supporting the Turo synagogue in Newport. Interestingly, Lopez was also giving tzedakah rations to poor Jews, and that included chocolate for the making of the drink. And he was also, according to his account books, drinking chocolate at Pesach, because we have a note in his account book that says he paid one of his chocolate grinders he paid him for 6 pounds of chocolate for Pesach. So that is the first note that I am aware of that connects Passover with chocolate. So these colonial North American Jews were very involved in the chocolate business.
Fascinating, fascinating. Okay, so when I think...
And so we're non-Jews.
Of course. When I think chocolate, as a kid growing up on the East Coast, so chocolate, the word chocolate, synonymous to chocolate was the word Barton's, because that was like the kosher chocolate company.
Yes.
When I was growing up. So tell us the history. What was the deal with Barton's?
Well, Barton's was owned by the Klein family. Stephen Klein had been living in Vienna when the Anschluss happened. His chocolate company there was confiscated. He left the next day or 2 days later for the States via Belgium. Ultimately, he was able to bring over his family, which was very important and a priority for him, and initially started out selling chocolate from push carts in various neighborhoods and apparently changed the flavoring to suit the interests of the various ethnic neighborhoods where he was selling chocolate. And that business evolved into Barton's Bonbonnier, which a lot of people remember so fondly and still exists but is no longer owned by the family. And what's great about this story is also their very deep Jewish roots and very deep Jewish commitments, very deep commitments to educating about Judaism. So they would take out advertisements in the New York Times about Jewish holidays. They were closed the factory on Jewish holidays and Shabbat. And he was very concerned about bringing over refugees. He had come as a refugee. He was very interested in bringing over refugees, and so he employed a number of refugees and helped other refugees, including some of his family members, get started in other businesses. And one of the businesses he helped start is a company called Madeleine, which is still in business in the Rockaways in New York, still very much committed to the Jewish community, still practicing Orthodox Judaism. And so he was very, very community-minded. His company was very Jewish. And yes, it was kosher, but it was also a really great product that people remember very fondly today.
Mm-hmm. So, excuse me, we're running out of time. But, okay, so let's put us up to 2017. Where are Jews now in the promulgation of chocolate around the world, Debbie Prince?
Good question. Thank you. Certainly, Israelis are very committed to their chocolate desserts and enjoyment of chocolate. And while I mentioned Elite Strauss earlier, there are certainly a number of other great companies in Israel. And so that I would highlight as an indication. There's a company in Switzerland called Camille Bloch, which is a three-generation-owned family-owned business, chocolate business. They used to export to Israel. I think they probably still do. The family members were very involved in the controversies over Swiss banking and the hidden records of Nazis. So the Camille Bloch story is a very interesting Jewish story, and they have also a lovely chocolate product, which I think can be accessed in the States as well as in Europe.
Yeah,
and
they do
in
sell it here in Detroit, yes.
I'm sorry?
They do sell it here in Detroit, yes.
Oh, okay, great, great, great. And there was a time in San Francisco until just a few years ago when there were a number of Jews in the chocolate business, interestingly enough. Charles Siegel is still in the chocolate business. Alice Medrich, who brought the French truffle to the States. Scharfenberger, which is no longer privately owned, but is owned by Hershey. Joseph Schmidt also was bought by Hershey, but there was a time when there were a number of Jewish chocolate makers in the San Francisco area. So Jews are consuming lots of chocolate and enjoying lots of chocolate, and I look forward to being in Detroit to share more stories about chocolate with the Detroit Jewish community.
Okay, you include a number of recipes in the book. The one which intrigued me, wondering if you had actually tried, and I'm assuming that you have since it's in the book and would recommend, is the first chocolate pudding, which doesn't sound like a pudding at all, but a cake, in the first Jewish cookbook and printed in America in 1871. So what's your opinion about that recipe?
Oh, it's good. First of all, we tested all of the recipes, and my editor was so excited about the recipes that she tested them. So they were double and triple tested, all of the contemporary and historical recipes. That recipe was quite tasty. There are a number of really great recipes in the book. One of my favorite is not a Jewish connection exactly, but is for the bicherin, since we're talking about consuming these drinks, the coffee, tea, and chocolate. This is from Turin, Italy, and it's a layer of chocolate, a layer of coffee, and a layer of cream that you cannot easily access anywhere in the States. And so the recipe helps people access it. But there are also recipes for Hanukkah and for Pesach and Parov possibilities and lots of great recipes.
Okay, this has actually been very wonderful. My board op is sitting here just like starry-eyed, just he's mesmerized. So our guest today has been Deborah Prince. She's written a book called On the Chocolate Trail, which you can buy, which I'm assuming. And Debbie will be at the DIA speaking about an illuminating and delectable experience in conjunction with the Detroit Institute of Arts Bittersweet Coffee, Tea, and Chocolate, Sunday, February 26th, 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. There is a charge. It's very limited space. You can go to jewishdetroit.org/chocolate. Contact 248-205-2557. That's 205-2557. Debbie will be there. We're going to try and be there. I would like to present you with a variety of chocolate, which is actually under my supervision. It's called Good Stuff Cacao. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's locally made here in Detroit, and it's organic, and it's free trade, and it doesn't have any sugar in it, and it's absolutely amazing, and people use it to, like, live on. So we're looking forward to meeting you, and thank you so much for taking time, Debbie.
I look forward to that, Herschel. Thank you so much. I will bring my brown signing pen so I can sign books for folks.
Thank you
so much.
Okay, thanks. Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. I told you that was going to be one of the more delectable interviews that we had. My wife actually comments, Hannah Finman, who's the co-producer of the show and my biggest fan and critic, happens to notice that when I'm talking about food, I get really into it, you know. So we had the gefilte fish thing a couple weeks ago, and now the chocolate thing, yes. So, yeah, I guess I can relate to food, you know. It's easy, you know. So I try to eat most days. I mean, you know, so. Anyway, up and coming now is a little bit of music interlude. This is Benny Friedman, brand new. The song is called Ivri Anochi. I'm a Jew, and I am proud.
אני הולך עם ראש למעלה, כל אחד הוא בן או בת של מלך. ככה היה וככה זה גם עלה, יהודים נשמה בוערת. בכל מקום ובכל ארץ, לא רוצה שיהיה אחרת. יהודי אני, זה משהו נצחי.
בני אברהם, יצחק ויעקב, בני ישראל יפקר אחר בלי.
And I will tell you, I'm a Jew and every Jew's a proud Jew. Not just me, my sisters and my brothers. Never be ashamed to be a proud Jew. It's not what you've done, it's how he made you. So sing the song and spread the pride around you. Yehudi ani, eternally.
Yehudi Abraham, Yitzchak v'Yaakov, v'nei Yisrael yivkor achel v'leah.
Of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We, believe it or not, are less than a month away from Purim. That's correct. Purim is exactly 4 Sundays from today. It's March the 12th, and Jewish Ferndale will be having 2 Purim readings. One is at the March the 11th at 8:30 p.m. will be the Megillah reading, followed by a showing of the animation film, The Purim Story, which was produced by Detroit's own Moshe Chassid. And then on March the 12th, we'll be having Purim Italiano Ebraica, which will be featuring the Purim Feast of Authentic Italian Jewish Cuisine with a Megillah reading. That's at 5:30, and there's a charge for that. You can find out about more about that at the Jewish Ferndale website, which is jewishferndale.com. We have then, because it is, for this song is called The Purim Song, and it is all over the place. I have many CDs with this song, specifically this song called The Purim Song. I'm not sure the provenance of this story. I'd like to get some backstory on this, because this song doesn't sound very Purim-esque to me. But since it's the Purim story, we have a group called the Klezmer Local 41. They're out of New York City, and this is The Purim Song. You or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com.
That's 888-637-6968. MDS Drug Detox.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. One thing that a lot of places do on Purim is they make these things called Purim spiels. They're like parodies that make fun of things, and sometimes political, sometimes nature of the whatever is involved with whatever organization is making the parody. And very often there are songs which are made, which are generally parodies of existing songs. They take an existing tune and put different words to it, you know, like the Schlockrock type of thing. So here, Michael Smolash, who is local to Detroit, put together a song called The Original Purim Song, and it's a parody of nothing because he made the whole thing up, but it's in the style of a parody. So that's a double Purim thing going on over here. Let's listen.
Can you try an original song in a Purim spiel? How would it make you feel?
We can always sing the Beatles, and the rabbis will be willing. And I know that we can count on the complete works of Bob Dylan.
We can film it on an iPhone and do half the tune in Yiddish. But if we don't set the words to Gangnam Style, will they gossip at the Kiddish?
Can you try an original song in a Purim spiel? Tell me, how would it make you feel? And can you write brand new music to go in a Purim video? Sadly, no one seems to know.
We can parody an opera in the style of Mario Lanza. But can an unknown song go viral? There's no relevant response.
We could all dress up like Vashti and play our crackers right till dawn, just as long as Esther's singing to some sweet Celine Dion. How did it make you feel?
Our original
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? The easiest way, go to rabbifinman.com. F-I-N-M-A-N. That's how we spell Finman, and rabbi is spelled like rabbi. You'll find archived editions of the show, ways in which yours truly conveys Judaism in an hopefully entertaining and enlightening way. And, of course, the donations page. Note our new address if you are mailing your donations. Keep those cards and letters coming, folks. 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Go to the website. Make it a monthly thing. Do it easy. We're still doing December. Yeah, I know. I'm getting tired of saying it, but I have often said that if we are not due money to the station, we don't do the drive appeal. So we've got 3 months to make up in like 1 month. We actually did that. We went through, I think it was July, August, and September. We paid all in September, and we went 1 week without having to do an appeal. And I told a longer story. It was much better. So go do that today. RabbiFinman.com. Drop it in the mail. Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. The portion of the week is to be found in, is called the portion of Yisro, is found in Exodus chapter 19 and following. The major thing that is mentioned in the story of Yisro is the giving of the Torah. Immediately following the giving of the Torah, it talks about building an altar. And it mentions there that the altar has to have a ramp. You cannot have an altar that has steps. This relates to the story that I'm going to tell you real quick. When the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose anniversary of his passing was this last week, was about 7-8 years old, so he went to listen to his father pray on Shabbos afternoon. Everybody was done. He had finished eating. He had visited his grandmother, and his father was still praying in the synagogue, and he couldn't understand. He was listening to his father that was saying words that were very slow. And at one point, when he got to like one of the crescendo prayers, the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, Lord our God, as long as," he burst into tears. And he couldn't understand it. It was very upsetting. So he asked his uncle, the rabbi's brother, "Why does his father daven so slow?" So the father, kibitzing, just said, "Oh, your father can't read very fast," which made the kid feel terrible. So he went and asked his mom, "What's the deal with dad?" I guess a Rebbe calls his father dad. "How come he's reading so slowly?" So she said, "Go ask your bubby, go ask your grandmother." And he's like really heartbroken. He's a 7 year old. He wants his father to be able to read as good as he can because he's like 7 years old and he can keep up with the synagogue prayers. So he went to ask the Rebbetzin Rivka, whose anniversary of her passing is also this last week. And she said, "Your father is a very Hasidic Yid. He's a very pious person. And when before he says every single word, he thinks about it. And he thinks, how is this word going to get him closer to God? And if he doesn't feel it, he breaks into tears because he wants to get closer to God like a child wanting getting close to a father who he can't see. So with this, the 8-year-old kid made a decision that if his father could do such a thing, would have his relationship with his father in heaven, that he decided right there at 8 years old that he was going to be a better son to his father. And indeed, we see the dedication that the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe had to his father, that at age 15 began involved with communal matters, and at age 17 became the headmaster in charge of the running of the yeshiva, and at age 30 took over as the next Rebbe without any thought about it, nothing. There was no go find somebody else. He knew he had to step in because this is what his father would have wanted. When we're talking about going up an altar, the whole purpose of the altar is to create a relationship with Hashem. The word karban, meaning sacrifice, comes from the Jewish word to come close, a communion with the Almighty. So for that, you don't take big giant steps. You don't open yourself up and gallop up. You do it, it's one step at a time. It's on an incline. It's just easy does it. And then every step that a person does, they're getting that much closer to God. That's going to do it. We thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.